This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The new rules for home lending. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is Thursday, January 10th. Long-awaited changes intended to make the mortgage market a little bit less of a menace to itself and to the rest of us, I guess. Plus, an experiment in fixing up public housing and more on President Obama's nominee for the one job in America where having a sloppy signature might actually matter.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is rolling out new guidelines for U.S. mortgages. The idea is to prevent the kind of Wild West that prevailed before the financial crisis, where the industry extended mortgages to many folks who couldn't afford them. Holden Lewis is an analyst at Bankrate.com. Good to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you.
These rules will go into effect in 2014, and what are some key aspects of them?
The key aspects are that the banks have to verify everything you say to them as far as your income, your assets, and your debts. And another is, with some exceptions, you can't have total debts of more than 43% of your income. So we're talking about your house payment, your car and student loans, credit card bills, child support, and alimony. All of those together shouldn't total more than 43% of your monthly income.
The rules also have something to say about the details, I guess, of mortgages that can be offered.
That's right. There's essentially a blanket ban on negative amortization mortgages, which are mortgages in which if you make the minimum payment, you end up owing more at the end of the month than you did at the beginning. Those have been dead for a long time, and they're going to remain buried.
There are a couple of complaints floating around about these new rules. One of them is that they may take some of the innovation, maybe, out of the mortgage business, making everything plain vanilla is the phrase that's being used. Is that a worry?
I don't think it's a worry to have mostly plain vanilla mortgages. A mortgage is kind of like a utility. You know, most consumers should just have plain vanilla mortgages. Nothing wrong with that.
The common sense reaction to tighter mortgage rules, I guess, is that that might make lenders clamp down. But I gather the opposite outcome is what is hoped for here. What do you expect?
You know, for 4 years, mortgage lenders have had strict lending standards, and those things won't change. Here's what will change. The next time there's a housing boom, it's going to be a lot more difficult for the lenders to relax their lending standards. They have this rule in effect. So this rule is designed to prevent lenders from losing their heads the next time there's a housing boom. You know, we're not in a credit mania. We're kind of in a credit crunch. And so there's really not going to be a whole lot of changes very soon.
Holden Lewis is an analyst with Bankrate.com. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
New research out of the UK this morning finds a staggering amount of food is wasted around the world every year. In fact, the study says we waste half of the 4 billion tons of food produced annually for human consumption. Whoa. Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The reasons for the wastage vary. In poor countries, it's due to inefficient farming, bad transport links, and a lack of refrigeration. In wealthier parts of the world, it's down to consumer pickiness. Supermarkets in the US and Britain reject almost a third of harvested fruit and vegetables just because they don't look appealing. And then American and British households throw away up to half the food they've purchased. Tim Fox is one of the authors of the report. He says the world can't afford this waste when there are going to be so many more mouths to feed.
As the global population moves towards 9.5 billion later this century, we're very concerned about how we're going to feed that population. Well, clearly, cutting down on this waste of food could go a very long way to meeting that need.
And he says this isn't just a matter of saving food. Food production uses a lot of energy. If Britain eliminated its household wastage alone, it would save as much fuel as if it had taken 20% of the cars off the road. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Well, the indexes have been up this morning, but not by much. The Dow and the S&P are both up just about 0.2%. The NASDAQ is flat so far. More Americans filed for unemployment last week, although the usual rush of post-holiday layoffs makes it kind of a tough week to read in terms of long-term trends. A few tidbits from this unfolding earnings season we are now in the midst of. Tiffany & Company has had a rough time of it during the past year, but the latest quarter for the luxury jeweler offered a glimmer of relief. Sales rose 4% during the holiday season. The company's holding steady to its previous profit forecast. And take a look at Super Value. The grocery company announced a profit for the latest quarter, but also announced it is selling five major chains to a private equity firm, including Albertsons and Jewel Osco. That leaves Super Value with Cub Foods and its food wholesaling business. Super Value shares this morning are up at this moment almost 12%. And Ford and GM want your apps. The two car makers announced at this week's Consumer Electronics Show that they are opening their dashboard computer systems to outside programmers. They want news, music, and other apps that are useful to drivers. Apps featuring video, playing games, or lots of reading will be automatically rejected for obvious reasons.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
New York's governor could soon announce his recommendations for measures to help keep the next hurricane from being as devastating as Sandy was. A commission's been weighing a number of proposals, among them massive barriers to block storm surge. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on the debate over this very expensive idea.
One proposal would put a barrier across the gateway to New York's harbor. Dennis Camber is with engineering firm Arcadis, which designed a concept for that spot a few years ago.
Something has to be done to protect that area. A barrier is one proven way to accomplish that.
The design could cost $6 billion. Malcolm Bowman and his team at State University of New York have looked at regional water barrier plans for nearly a decade. He favors a longer and pricier structure further out.
It's expensive, but if you compare it to the damage that Sandy created, it puts it in perspective.
Official damage estimates top $80 billion, but Sandy was a historic event. Planning for a repeat may be a bad bet. Also, a barrier could harm the environment and make storm surge worse in the areas immediately outside the structure. Critics include Philip Orton of Stevens Institute of Technology.
People aren't going to be supportive of all this because of all the negative aspects.
A barrier system would come only after years of study and construction, so the debate is far from over. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Today in Savannah, Georgia, the head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development unveils a pilot program. It is meant to address the poor conditions in public housing developments. And HUD's idea here is to let outside investors fix them up. Marketplace's Jim Burris has more.
For the past 6 years, Tamika Cummings has made 3219B in Toby Grant Manor home.
I'm very grateful for the Housing Authority for allowing me to be able to live here, grow, raise my children.
The 37-year-old and three of her five kids share a no-frills duplex near Atlanta. It's basic red brick with cinder block walls.
The units, I mean, they're old. You know, I'm thankful for them, grateful. You know, a lot of people don't understand that, but it's time for something new.
It's been around since the mid-60s. I believe it was built in 67 and 68.
Pete Walker heads DeKalb County's Housing Authority. He says times have changed. The concept of public housing has changed. But this place hasn't. Walker thinks it's time for something new.
What we would be looking at in redeveloping this property would be a complete teardown. We'd start over.
The problem, like tens of thousands of other subsidized developments, Toby Grant Manor falls under Section 9 of the Federal Housing Act. Any money to fix it up has to come from the government, and HUD is about $26 billion short. That's why HUD Secretary Sean Donovan says shifting properties like Toby Grant Manor to Section 8 gives more options.
When we move them into Section 8, what we do is we cut red tape.
Section 8 allows for private investors to front money for repairs and redevelopment. HUD then pays them back under a long-term contract. Donovan says the shift doesn't cost taxpayers a penny extra. Mark Calabria of the right-leaning Cato Institute says the switch isn't a perfect fix, but
I think it's a step in the right direction.
In the first 30 days of the national pilot program, HUD has raised $650 million in private investment. That's enough money to tear down and redevelop 17 Toby Grant Manors. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Well, we caught this breaking story just in time to let you know about it yesterday on the podcast. And indeed, this afternoon, President Obama will nominate Jack Lew to replace Tim Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury. Lew is currently the White House Chief of Staff. Now, the guy who broke this story and set the media humming yesterday morning was Hans Nichols of Bloomberg News. Earlier today, he talked with my Morning Report colleague, Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
Well, what do we need to know about Jack Lew?
He's an insider and he has the president's trust and he can do the budget. If you can, you know, do long algebraic equations backwards, Jack Lew can do the budget backwards. He knows it cold. He's been budget director twice. No one knows the better numbers better than Jack Lew.
And he's really going to be a guy who will focus on the budget, on Congress, as opposed to Wall Street. Because I know last time President Obama was picking a Treasury secretary 4 years ago, the focus really had to be on Wall Street during the crisis.
You had a financial crisis. I mean, the problem with that frame, and this is one of the reasons why the White House dithered on picking Jack Lew, is because you don't necessarily know that there isn't going to be another financial crisis. Europe has not exactly solved itself in terms of their debt crisis. So your next – and Lew does have some international experience because he was number two at the State Department. That's not international economic experience with international bond market, capital markets. That's why they need to bring in number two. Rather, that's why they're thinking of bringing in a number two who's from Wall Street, a Wall Street executive, and also can kind of smooth over relations with the business community. You know, Geithner came from up there. There's, you know, commonly misreported that Geithner came from Goldman Sachs or was from Wall Street. No, he was
right.
At the Fed, but that's a regulator position. So it wasn't like Geithner was kind of a bad cop to Wall Street in a way throughout the early hours and early months of the crisis.
What do Jack Lew's critics say about him?
That he drives too hard of a bargain and he's too darn smart. That's the main criticism that you get from Republicans that during the 2011 debt negotiation, they said, we don't want to work with Jack Lew anymore. He's driving too hard of a bargain. Give us Gene Sperling. So, you know, and he doesn't have a great relationship with John Boehner. John Boehner and Tim Geithner developed a relationship eventually. I mean, 2 years ago, Boehner was calling for Geithner to resign. And now, boy, Boehner would sure like Geithner to stay on. Geithner clearly wants to get out of here. So if there's a criticism, it's that he's a bit, I don't want to say gruff, but he's not exactly a backslapper and doesn't get all along that well with the other party.
Hans Nichols, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Obama's nomination of Jack Lew has sparked one controversy that has nothing to do with his ideology or his credentials. It is his signature. The Treasury Secretary's signature, of course, appears on every dollar bill that's minted during his tenure. And I guess I'm no one really to talk, but Jack Lew's signature is basically a series of 8 loops in a row. What bloggers this morning have variously described as, quote, a youngster's first attempt at writing cursive, and the markings left on a notepad when you can't seem to get your pen working. That last one seems particularly apt to me if you've actually seen the signature. On the other hand, one handwriting analyst who was contacted by the Washington Post says it shows he has a softer side. She says Princess Diana had similar penmanship. And that is today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.